This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Policing is built on the assumption that people must be policed, that humanity's innate grubbiness requires an unyielding hand. In fact, most of our institutions are based on the dark view that our natural state is the war of all against all. In the words of the 17th century pessimist, some say realist, Thomas Hobbes. Whereas the Enlightenment philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau maintained that once we lived peacefully in harmony with nature and without rulers, until so-called civilization diminished us and cast us from Eden. For centuries, that view was dismissed as downright pie-eyed. But economic historian Rutger Bregman points to a wealth of research suggesting that Rousseau was the realist. Bregman's new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History, argues that people may not be precisely good, but they are decent, despite what our rulers would have us believe. For centuries, they've insisted that without them, chaos would ensue.
There's a very old idea in Western culture which says that civilization is only a thin veneer, and that when something happens, say a crisis, for example, we become savages, animals, monsters, and that we reveal who we really are. Now, this idea goes back all the way to the ancient Greeks. You find it with the Greek historian Thucydides, for example. You find it with the early Christian church fathers, St. Augustine, talking about the concept of original sin. The founding fathers, John Adams, he once wrote an essay with the title, All Men Would Be Tyrants If They Could. And I think the idea is also embedded at the heart of our current capitalist system, the notion that people deep down are just selfish. Veneer theory is simply wrong. A huge amount of evidence from sociology and anthropology and archaeology and psychology basically points in a very different direction, that deep down, most people are pretty decent. With maybe one thing I should add there, which is that power corrupts.
You taught me the term nocebo, the idea that negative expectations yield negative outcomes.
What we assume in other people is what we get out of them. So if we assume that most people are selfish, then we'll design our institutions around that idea, our schools, our workplaces, our democracy, and we'll bring out exactly that kind of behavior. Now, there's been some really interesting research into the Pygmalion effect. So indeed, Robert Rosenthal is a psychologist who did this research for the first time in the 60s, and he had mice. And in one cage, he would say, these mice are very smart. And on the other case, you would say, these mice are very stupid and slow, etc. In reality, they were just normal mice that were used for laboratory experiments. Then he let the students come in and say, okay, you've got to put this animal in a maze and record how quickly they find the exit. Amazingly, the supposedly smart mice were faster. But after a while, he came to realize that the way these animals were treated by the students with more expectations, with more trust, I don't know, a bit more caring, that made all the difference. So it was a performative effect. What we assume in each other is what we get out of each other.
How do you see your book fitting into this moment?
Yeah. You know, it's a very strange time, obviously, to be publishing a book about human kindness and human friendliness. Some people might think, when they look at savage behavior from police in the streets, and think, this is what happens when you put people in a uniform and you give them a bit of power. I think that's wrong.
I know this week you've seen the Stanford prison experiment used to explain police brutality.
Yeah. The Stanford prison experiment is one of the most famous experiments in psychology. 24 students divided in two groups, guards and prisoners. Supposedly, these students very quickly turned into monsters, and the experiment had to be canceled after a couple of days.
Afterwards, when I began to reflect on what I had done, that this behavior began to dawn on me, and I realized that this was This was a part of me I hadn't really noticed before.
Deep down, yeah, we're all savages and evil. We've only recently learned, actually, after the groundbreaking work of a French sociologist called Thibault Le Texier, who was the first one to go into the archives of the Stanford Prison Experiment, that actually, it's a hoax. Philip Zimbardo specifically instructed his students to be as sadistic as possible. Now, many of those guards said, no, 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 I don't want to do that. That's not who I am. Then Zimbardo said, no, you got to do this because then we can go to the press and say, look how horrible prisons are. And so some of them went along. And a couple of days after the experiment, Zimbardo immediately went to the press and it became this huge thing.
A huge and enduring thing.
And you're right. It was used again this week to explain the terrible police violence that we see. But I think we have to go much deeper here. One of the striking findings from military historians in the past couple of decades is that most soldiers, especially when they were just average drafted soldiers, they couldn't fire their guns. American soldiers during the Second World War, many of them just couldn't do it. I think the central mechanism here that makes people able to be violent is distance. So on the one hand, there's physical distance. We know in the First World War, like 70 to 80% of all casualties were from artillery.
But in this case, in the streets, we see the police directly putting their hands on protesters.
Here, there's another mechanism at play, which is the psychological distance. These cops have been conditioned both by centuries of institutionalized racism, but also specific police training to look at average citizens and see enemies. To be honest, it astonishes me. I knew that policing is in a really bad state in the US. I'm not saying that we don't have terrible incidents like that as well here. I'm from the Netherlands. We have a huge amount of racism as well. But if you look at police training, in the US, on average, it lasts like 18 to 19 weeks, something like that. In most European countries, it takes more than 2 years. And you equip them like they're soldiers in Iraq or something like that. It's so crazy to look at.
So let's rewind a little, a lot, and pick up the story at the dawn of human history. You say that our hunter-gatherer forebears have an unjustifiably bad rep.
If you look at the archaeological evidence, there's actually almost no evidence for war in our deep history. All the evidence we have suggests that war had a beginning, when we became sedentary, when we settled down, then we became farmers. We also have the anthropological evidence. So what you can do as a scientist is study tribes in the 19th century, in the 20th century, or today, who still have this nomadic hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Whether these nomadic hunter-gatherers live in the Kalahari Desert or in Alaska, there are really some striking similarities. For example, they have very egalitarian cultures. I mean, biologists talk about survival of the friendliest, which means that for millennia, it was actually the friendliest among us who had the most kids and still had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation. Because friends helped you to survive. Imagine Donald Trump in prehistory. He wouldn't have survived for long. This is one of the, I think, the great indictments of the society we live in right now, is that it's not survival of the friendliest anymore. It's often survival of the shameless.
You talk about Dacher Keltner, an expert on applied Machiavellianism. And he calls this the power paradox. Even if we pick who appear to be the most modest and kind-hearted individuals to lead us, eventually power corrupts. And the people in power think that the people they lead, the rest of us, are as immoral as they because they assume we would behave as they do.
Yeah. And nomadic hunter-gatherers already knew this. They knew that power corrupts. And so they used the power of shame and of peer pressure to keep those at the top in check. But then, after we became sedentary, we got these hierarchies and leaders who wanted to wage wars and increase their dominance and increase their authority.
Another point that you raised was that the development of friendliness went side by side with the development of brain power. There was an evolutionary biologist, you quote, Brian Hare, who said up until now, the assumption has always been that domestication diminishes brain power, literally reducing gray matter in the brain. But he came to a completely different conclusion.
Yes. Scientists have a long list of traits. they refer to this whole list as the domestication syndrome that all these domesticated species share. Thinner bones, smaller brain, floppy ears, and most importantly, they just look a bit more childish, or the scientific term is pedomorphic. Mm-hmm. Just look a bit puppyish. Now, if you look at this list, and if you also look at the genes that are associated with the domestication syndrome, and then you look at us, you realize we look pretty domesticated. But then the question is, who did it? And the answer is, we did it ourselves. This theory is called self-domestication. Over the millennia, it was the friendliest among us, the tamest among us, who had the most kids, and so had the biggest chance of passing on their genes. I've come up with a term for this, and I hope history will remember me for it. Homo puppy. Even though the size of our brains, you know, became smaller, our social intelligence increased. We became better at learning from each other. One of the most beautiful pieces of evidence we have for this is a really fascinating experiment in Russia that started in the 1950s, when it was actually illegal and very dangerous to study genetics. And there was a Russian scientist called Dmitry Belyaev, and he started an experiment with silver foxes, a species that had never been domesticated up until then. And he sort of wanted to do in a couple of years or decades what, you know, normally would take centuries or even longer. Mm-hmm. For years, he selected the friendliest silver foxes to breed with each other. And he started to see that this whole domestication syndrome appeared, right?
They ended up looking and behaving like puppies.
Yeah. But even more interestingly, Brian Hare did intelligence tests with the wild silver foxes and the domesticated silver foxes. The domesticated silver foxes were smarter. So Brian Hare says, if you want a smart fox, you don't select for intelligence, you select for friendliness. The theory is that this also happened in our evolution. We've been selected for friendliness, and that's exactly what made us so smart.
You noted that there were some social and psychological experiments after the Second World War used to support the veneer theory of civilization to show how basically everyone has the capacity to become a Nazi. Can we zero in on the Milgram experiment from the 60s? Why did the experiment not tell us what we think it does?
What you had was an experiment in which someone was asked to do a sort of an intelligence test with someone else who was in reality actually an accomplice of the researcher. And then if that person made a mistake, the subject was asked to give electric shocks.
You're going to get a shock, 180 volts.
I can't stand the pain. Let me out of here.
You can't stand it. I'm not going to kill that man, is there? I mean, who's going to take the responsibility if anything happens to that gentleman?
I'm responsible for anything that happens here.
Those electric shocks started at 15 volts, then to 30, 45, 60 volts, etc. All the way up until 450 volts.
It could kill someone.
Yeah, and so the shocking headline of this study was that 65% of average Americans were willing to go all the way to 450 volts.
That's a lot of Nazis.
Yeah. Now, just like with the Stanford Prison Experiment, the archives have opened up. An Australian psychologist, Gina Perry, discovered that actually a huge amount of the subjects didn't really believe the situation they were in. They thought, this can't be real, right? I'm at Yale University and I'm supposed to be killing someone else here. I mean, that's probably not the case. You know what? I'll just get along with this. I must say, though, that the Milgram experiment has been replicated. And even if it's not 65%, but it's still way too high. You would hope that only the psychopaths and the sociopaths do something like that, like only 1%, but that's clearly not the case. So what's going on here? There's a new generation of psychologists that believe that the experiments are actually not about blind obedience, but about followership. The subjects want to be helpful, and they're being pulled along in this way. This is not a comfortable message. It's actually the dark side of friendliness. If you think about it, so many of the great atrocities in our history were actually committed in the name of loyalty, comradeship, right? There's a really dark side to our capacity for friendship, which is sort of the tribal behavior, the groupish behavior.
In the Milgram experiment, you point out that it wasn't about obedience, which is what it was supposed to test. This research initially was happening roughly the same time as the Adolf Eichmann trial. And the philosopher Hannah Arendt, covering the trial at the time, didn't agree with Milgram's initial conclusions about obedience, even though Arendt and Milgram have been linked. She saw that Eichmann was not obeying. He was conforming.
In my book, I've got one chapter about the question why German soldiers were fighting so hard still in 1944, 1945, when it was clear that they were going to lose the war. And the Allied psychologists, they couldn't really understand it. They thought, they must have been brainwashed. But then they started interviewing prisoners of war and discovered that actually these soldiers were not so much motivated by ideology or blind hatred, but by comradeship. They didn't want to let their friends down. And now we have a lot of evidence for that in the case of the Wehrmacht. But obviously, if you look at the fanatical SS guards, you need something else, right? What you encounter there is more this shocking ideology where these people believe that they were actually improving the world if they were killing Jews.
Another pillar, as long as we're knocking them down, of our negative view of human nature is the Lord of the Flies. This book won the Nobel Prize when it was written back in the 50s.
Yes.
It's practically a shorthand, even though it's a fiction, for the argument that we are fundamentally Hobbesian.
Yes.
You found, though, a true story, long forgotten, boys swept onto their own island. Nothing like what William Golding wrote. And it's going to be made into a movie. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, I read Lord of the Flies when I was 16 years old. Still, millions of kids have to read Lord of the Flies in school. I wondered, is there one case where real kids actually shipwrecked on an island? After a lot of research, I found one example in 1965 near Tonga, an island group in the Pacific Ocean. A group of six Tongan kids who were fed up with boarding school. They stole, or borrowed, I should say in their words, they borrowed a boat and they ended up in a storm. And they drifted for 8 days until they shipwrecked on the island of Ata, which is like a volcanic island. It's a rock that sticks out of the ocean. I managed to track down two of the six of the original Lord of the Flies kids. I also managed to find the captain who rescued them in 1966.
Amazing.
They worked together really well on that island in teams of two to tend to the garden, to be on the lookout.
To tend to the fire.
They managed to get a fire starting after 3 months and they never let it go out. You know, remember what happens in the fictional Lord of the Flies. They have this fire and the half of the island burns down and they become savages. The real Lord of the Flies is in every single way the opposite of the fictional Lord of the Flies.
Why do you think the veneer theory keeps returning?
I think that cynicism is another word for laziness.
Mm-hmm.
Activism becomes pointless when things are lost anyway. Think about what the news does to us. You know, I really believe in investigative journalism that helps to uncover the structural forces that govern our lives. But Trump is very happy if we watch Fox News and CNN all day, because then we become scared.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to rule people who are scared. It's important to emphasize that a cynical view of human nature has always been used by those in power, because it legitimizes their power. If we can't trust each other, then we need them. We need kings and presidents and the army and the police to keep us in check. Now, if I'm saying most people are pretty decent, that's a very dangerous statement. If you really think it through, it means a revolution. Now we have a system that is all about distrusting the poor. So you have to prove over and over again that you're sick enough, that you're depressed enough, that you're really a hopeless case. And then maybe you'll receive a little bit of food stamps. But this is a system that creates dependency, depression, and anxiety.
What happens when authorities do trust the people?
Now, if you turn it around and if you actually say, I trust you, then here's a bit of venture capital. Let's call it a basic income. And you can decide for yourself what you want to do with the money. Then something very different happens. It's the same as with the experiment with the mice, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you assume in other people is what you get out of them. So we've got an extraordinary amount of evidence that in basic income experiments, you see crime dropping, you see kids performing better in school, you see the health of people improve. And it's actually an investment that pays for itself, because poverty is really, really expensive in terms of policing costs and judicial costs and healthcare, you name it.
So the logical conclusion of understanding that people are fundamentally decent, kind of an argument for not needing police at all, for anarcho-syndicalism. I mean, Where does this all get us?
The problem with anarchists is that they're not very good at building institutions.
Do we need institutions?
Absolutely. We need to build different schools. We need to build different workplaces, democracies, police forces, you name it, all based on a different view of human nature, because people are a product of the institutions in which they grow up.
You conclude your book with, I guess you'd call them a series of tips.
Rules to live by.
What would you consider the most important?
When in doubt, assume the best. Why? Because in most of the cases, we'll be right. I mean, that's just empirically true because most people are decent. In the second place, you know, behavior can be contagious. People mirror each other. So if someone is not doing nasty to you and you do nice to that person, then often that other person can't resist reacting in a nice way as well. Then you can say, well, Rutger, but there are still people who are going to rip you off and you're so vulnerable to that. And I'm saying then, yes, that's true. And it's collateral damage. Because what's the alternative? Do you really want to live a whole life distrusting everyone around you so that you'll never be conned? That price is way too high. So just accept that you'll be conned a couple of times in your life. It's the rational thing to do. And if you've never been conned, you should ask yourself, what's wrong with me? Is my basic attitude to life trusting enough?
Rutger, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Rutger Bregman is the author of Humankind, A Hopeful History. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.